what do you think police should do? And then he said, oh, police should serve and protect our community. Oh, why did you scare? Why do you feel fear?
We have been called for emergency actions on a regular basis because a tenant has been evicted, and we find that the police officers are doing very little to nothing to protect these tenants from an illegal eviction.
The problem is that there's a whole bunch of chemicals that are with all this mud that they're bringing and water, wastewater on the beach. And we have had seals dead, fishes dead on our shores because of all this talk.
From Pacifica Radio, KPFK in Los Angeles, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates, focused on COVID-19 and the many ways in which this pandemic touches people's lives. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, the United States Supreme Court blocks President Donald Trump's efforts to end the Deferred Action Program for certain undocumented immigrants who came to the United States when they were children. In Tijuana, Mexico, a pastor in charge of an immigrant shelter says he has received death threats after he denounced dumping of toxic waste near a residential area. And a special report on the effects of COVID-19 on urban indigenous communities. But first, the news.
These are the headlines for Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Maeve Conran. The World Health Organization is warning of a second wave of the coronavirus as it announced the highest daily rise in new cases since the pandemic began. On Sunday, the WHO announced more than 183,000 new confirmed coronavirus cases worldwide. Brazil had the highest number of new infections and has become the second country after the US to register more than 50,000 deaths from COVID-19. The country's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, continues to oppose lockdown. 29 states and US territories have reported increases in new coronavirus cases after many states have begun to ease lockdown restrictions. Public health officials had raised concerns about President Trump's rally over the weekend in Tulsa, Oklahoma, being a super spreader event for the coronavirus. Trump held the rally on Saturday in an arena with a capacity for 19,000 people. However, only an estimated 6,000 people attended. A planned address by Trump and Vice President Mike Pence to an overflow crowd outside the arena was cancelled because nobody was there. One reason given for the small numbers is a social media campaign by TikTok users and K-pop fans who allegedly trolled the Trump campaign, reserving thousands of tickets with no plans to actually attend the rally. During the rally itself, Trump continued to use racist language in discussing the coronavirus, referring to it as Kung Flu. Trump also called for an end to widespread testing, saying that when you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people, you're going to find more cases. Prior to Saturday, six Trump campaign staff members tested positive for the coronavirus. Black Lives Matter protests continued around the world over the weekend. On Saturday, thousands rallied in London for the fourth weekend of protests. Activists are calling for the UK to address its own legacy of racism, colonialism and slave trading. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson has pledged to set up a commission to address racial inequality. But critics say they want more urgent action, including immediate compensation for the Windrush generation. Today, June 22nd, is Windrush Day. It commemorates the arrival in the UK of the Empire Windrush in 1948. The boat brought people from the Caribbean who were invited to help rebuild the UK after World War II. In all, nearly 500,000 people came from the Caribbean to the UK to help with labour shortages. However, in recent years, many were wrongfully identified as undocumented immigrants. Thousands were detained and denied legal rights. Nearly 100 people were actually deported, having worked and lived in the UK for decades. This was under a 2012 UK immigration policy called Hostile Environment. A review into the scandal led to the establishment of a compensation program for those who had been wrongfully detained or deported. However, only a small number of claimants actually received payments. The hostile environment immigration policy remains in place in the UK. On Friday, Colorado became one of the first states in the country to strip police officers of a legal defense known as qualified immunity. That means victims or their families can now sue police officers for constitutional violations, and those officers can be held personally liable. Colorado Governor Jared Polis signed the sweeping legislation on police accountability into law on Friday, Juneteenth. And those are the headlines in today's news. I'm Maeve Conran from KGNU Community Radio in Boulder, Colorado.
You are listening to COVID, Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumpfee. In a 5-4 ruling, the United States Supreme Court found that the administration violated the Administrative Procedures Act, or the APA, when it sought to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, also known as DACA, in September of 2017. While the court's holding does not say that the White House lacks the authority to end DACA, it did find that the manner in which the decision was made and announced was arbitrary and capricious and violated the law. The ruling allows 700,000 current DACA recipients to remain in place, giving temporary relief to DACA recipients and their families. Jung-Woo Kim, organizing director at the National Korean American Services and Education Consortium, or NACASEC, joins us to tell us what this means. NACASEC is a grassroots organization founded in 1994. Their mission is to organize Korean and Asian Americans to achieve social, economic, and racial justice. Greetings, Jung-Woo. Thank you for joining us. What does this recent decision by the Supreme Court mean for Asian DACA recipients who are often invisibilized in the general public DACA discourse?
Yes, there are about like 700,000 DACA recipients in this country, and about 5% of DACA recipients are Asian Americans. And out of that, Korean Americans are most DACA recipients among all Asians DACA recipients. So as a Korean American DACA recipient, it means a lot that we were able to keep the DACA, because of personally, I thought we're going to lose. This administration, Trump administration, is like very horrible on immigration. And not only that, like if you look at the justices, there's 5 conservative and 4 liberal. So last 3 years, we're able to do everything that we can do to defend DACA. In 2017, I think we stand in front of the White House for 22 days, for 24/7 vigil. And also 2018, we rode a bicycle from Seattle to San Diego with undocumented community members. And last year, we marched from New York to D.C. to defend DACA. It means a lot to our community, but we should not complacent on DACA for sure, because it's still temporary protections. I personally want on my citizenship right now. I think I deserve it. I believe there are more than 11.2 million undocumented immigrants in this country. They deserve the citizenship right now too. So we still want citizenship for all undocumented immigrants. We want to abolish ICE, and we want dignity. So in order for us to do that, I think we should keep moving forward, not just settling what we have right now. And we, first of all, we need to get rid of the Trump administrations, and win these elections so we can have citizenship for all.
When we look at African Americans, you know, and we talk about deserving citizenship, right?
When
we look at African Americans, clearly 400 and more years of putting in free toil, labor, intellectual property, effort, everything, cultural a property into this country, folks who have fought in wars, every single war that this country has ever had, mm-hmm. who, you know, we just recently celebrated Juneteenth, you know, mm-hmm. were emancipated and then became citizens because of the 14th Amendment, which is the same way that if you have children born here, how your children also become citizens, right? Mm-hmm. And yet we see how African Americans are not treated as if their citizenship is worth anything, right? They're not provided or given the access to the American dream. In fact, anti-Blackness permeates every single part of the systems of this society. And so citizenship has not kept them from being the victims of racial terror. And so as immigrants, when we, and I'm concluding myself, right, when we talk about citizenship and we look at these uprisings that have been occurring across this country in support of Black lives, what, you know, how does this DACA decision, how does this pursuit of citizenship on the part of non-Black immigrants of color, how does that connect to these uprisings that have been happening and other work in support of Black lives?
Personally, I feel we owe a lot to Black community. For example, there's one example. 1965 Immigration Act passed, right? Because of civil rights movement. And after that 1965 Immigration Act passed, more than 7 million Asian Americans were able to migrate by family reunification program and H-1 visa and those other visas out there. So it's led by, you got to remember that it's led by Black people, Black community leaders, and their community members as well. So I think this is our time to do our part. For example, I mean, we're still internally discussing about how we can connect the dot with abolish ICE and defund the police. For example, I asked this question to my uncle. Hey, he's kind of like he's 60. And he asked me the question, hey, why do we have to defund the police, you know? And I asked him, hey, what do you think police should do? And then he said, oh, police should serve and protect our community. Okay. And I asked the one question. Do you, when you see the police, what do you feel? He said, oh, fear. I fear.
Great question.
Fear. Okay, then why do you feel fear? If you know that in your mind that they're here to serve you, to protect you, do you think that's normal? No, and he said, I never thought about it. Yeah, right? That is that right there. It's not just for Black people. It's for you too, you know? Why do you have to fear? Then maybe they're not doing their work right. Right? So after that, like a couple of days later, he came back to me during the dinner table and he said, yeah, you're right. You know, you're damn right. Because he came from Korea. Korea is different, different vibe. I'm not saying Korean police is better. I'm saying he said he never felt that scared, that fearness, you know, fear. Because this police system is created, deeply rooted into by like racism to policing, maybe just protect just white people. I'm not sure. But policing other than white.
Let me ask this question about COVID, because again, when we talk about COVID, what people think of when they think of Asians is, you know, they're the ones that brought COVID to our country or to the world and blah, 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 right? And so there was really serious anti-Asian, not just sentiment, not just rhetoric, but actual violence. And so what has NACASEC done? What are you doing to address that anti-Asian sentiment that's always been there, but really came to the forefront with COVID-19?
That's a really good question. Thanks for bringing that up. It means a lot. Because of anti Asian sentiment spreading, widespread, during the COVID-19. There's a lot of hate crime in this in our community. But my mom, specifically, she came to me and asked, "Hey, I'm really afraid to go outside after sunset to go to grocery stuff because one of her friends had some like very bad experience." What we have done and what we've been doing is like a couple of, I would say, community action time is like we gather our community members and also allies who want support and have a meeting and also start a call and send the letters to senators and House representative, elected official to share the statement because of what Trump said, you know, like Chinese virus stuff. It's wrong. You got to say it. If you just be quiet, do nothing, then you are with them.
Woo Kim, organizing director at the National Korean American Services and Education Consortium, or NAKASEC. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Nana.
In times of mass unemployment and economic hardship resulting from the COVID pandemic, grassroots activists have been organizing on a neighborhood level to prevent illegal evictions and build solidarity.
My name is Patty Chavez. I'm a local activist and advocate for immigrant rights in California. I'm a member of an independent group that work together for the betterment of our community. We are Todos Somos Uno California. We are the voice of the most vulnerable in our society, the undocumented workers. During COVID-19, we noticed that our community was severely affected, not only by the current health risk and consequences of COVID, but also by the injustices and lack of government aid. Many Black and Hispanic families are being illegally evicted during this pandemic, even though there is a rent moratorium in place in the state of California, and no one should have to worry about being evicted. We knew that police officers were not going to be enforcing evictions and that the courts would not be accepting any eviction cases. However, we have been called for emergency actions on a regular basis because a tenant is being evicted and we find that the police officers are doing very little to nothing to protect these tenants from an illegal eviction. On many occasions, we have had to go rescue a tenant with over 50 volunteers, a couple of attorneys, the media, and legal observers to ensure that the tenant's rights are being respected and that the law is being enforced. We also fight for immigrant rights in California by organizing and participating in peaceful protest. During our actions, we promote love and unity, but also inform others of the rights and give them legal resources when necessary. We fight for justice and equality for all and expose local corruption at a state level. We want local politicians to know that we are watching, and that we will expose them and hold them accountable when they don't act accordingly and with integrity. During the last couple weeks, our team has continuously fought against the privatization of water at the Central Basin, which distributes water to 24 cities and over 2 million people in Southeast Los Angeles. One of our main objectives is for our community to know that there are organizations and volunteers who care about their well-being and who are doing what they can to help others and protect their rights. We must fight the system together because it was not designed to protect minorities, but to protect the wealthy. That is what I have witnessed. I'm here to speak on behalf of my brothers and sisters who have no voice and suffer the discrimination of the people in power. Undocumented workers are the workforce of America, and them too need to be protected and helped. I stand for freedom and equality for all. We don't need a wall to divide us, but bridges to unite us.
Patty Chavez is an activist and a grassroots organizer. You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, brought to you by Pacifica Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
Hello. cielo que se levanta todos los días con el sol. Todos los días, todos los días.
Todos los días con el sol.
Tierra en las uñas, sol en la cara. Bolsa en la espalda porque pesa la carga. Callos en las manos, sangre en los pies. Caminando dos horas porque aquí no hay tren. El choclo se cosecha, le da sombra al poroto. Semillas en la tierra y ojalá que llueva pronto. Quizás le dicen loco porque vive de la tierra. El camino para su hogar se ilumina con estrella. Pero él se quiere ir, lejos de aquí. Quizás camino norte to the land of the free. La cosa ha cambiado, todo lo compraron. United States, United Fruit y Monsanto. Tratado de comercio, cambiar el universo que dejaron los ancestros. Solo hechos, todavía falta techo. Todavía hay alegría, alegre rebeldía que se vive día a día.
Campesino se defiende, esa tierra no se vende. No se rinde, se trabaja, se organiza en un frente. Populares de la calle, apoyando el que trae comida a nuestros hogares. Ahora bajo rayos solares, condiciones poco humanas. La maniobra es barata, un variable matemático para asegurar la ganancia. Pero ellos no me ganan, tengo más ganas. La memoria, la historia me hace creer en mañana. Hasta la victoria nos dijeron, no cederemos el terreno. No aceptamos el imperio, en el desierto no lo tenemos. La copa de mojale, tomate, azúcar, café. El corto quizás no se ve, el obrero explotado. El rico acomodado, el resto mal informado. Así mantienen calmado la masa. Comida hecha en casa, semilla fabricada, contaminada. Quieren matar a Pachamama.
Aquí no hay relevo, soy Evo, soy cocalero. Tu piel que brilla resiste la resolana. Sé bien, todas las horas son lunes por la mañana. Sus musas de porcelana no cuadran en tu ventana. Damos el mundo sonrisas con obsidiana. Es jaula de oro que expone nuestro holocausto.
We just heard the track Campesino by the band Rebel Diaz. Welcome back to Pacifica's national broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. In Tijuana, Mexico, Albert Rivera, a pastor in charge of an immigrant shelter, says he has received death threats after he denounced dumping of toxic waste near a residential area. Dave Adelson is an independent journalist based in Los Angeles. He has followed this case closely and has spoken to Pastor Rivera himself.
They have headaches, they have vomiting, diarrhea. Sometimes they get like they're coughing.
Pastor Albert Rivera is director of Agape Misión Mundial, a migrant shelter or albergue in the border town of Tijuana in the Mexican state of Baja California. Agape houses on the order of 150 refugees and asylum seekers at any given time. These migrants typically spend many months there awaiting asylum hearings in the U.S., under the provisions of a treaty known as the Migrant Protection Protocols, enacted in early 2019 as part of the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico policy for asylum seekers. Since February of 2020, Pastor Rivera and the migrants have encountered a new challenge, the dumping of toxic sludge on open land right next to Agape, on the premises of EcoWaste, a private company contracted by the Baja State Public Services Agency, CESPT, to receive the waste. This sludge seeps daily from Mexico into the U.S. under the border wall and is brought back across the border by CESPT trucks by treaty agreement and under the auspices of CESPT.
When the dumping gets real hard and everything, so we have protested, and when we protest, they're not dumping that much during the day, but they're doing the dumping between at 8 to about 4 o'clock in the morning. They start dumping the one that really smells real terrible at that time. And the other ways that they're bringing, it looks like they put something, they cover it right quick, and but when it's in during the daytime.
For Pastor Rivera, this is the worst time to expose the local population and the asylum seekers to such dangerous substances?
The problem is that there's a whole bunch of chemicals that are with all this mud that they're bringing and water, wastewater, and there's no way to treat it. And the main issue is, okay, well, we're going through a pandemic right now, and for them to be dumping this in the plane in the middle of a pandemic, and then for them not to have a treatment plan, and it's not being all these chemicals and everything's not being treated, it's a big health problem that we're facing.
But despite these challenges, Rivera and several community members and attorneys have decided to put up a fight.
We have a whole bunch of communities. We have about 70 business people that have little business and everything that are joining up all together. There's 5 community groups that are actually being affected. And there's actually about 7 attorneys with different clients that's against EcoWaste.
Environmental attorney Jason Sanders of the Los Angeles firm Venskus & Associates commented on the issues of environmental racism at stake in cases like this.
Fighting for environmental justice has never been more important, especially in our current climate. You know, too often our people of color and the economically disadvantaged disproportionately affected by decisions regarding the location of high pollution sites. Too often are the same people asked to carry the environmental burden without sharing in any of the environmental benefits associated with these decisions.
Pastor Rivera has endured harassment and violent behavior from some of the company personnel, including drivers and security guards.
We're having a problem with EcoWaste because we have protested one of the drivers just because I was taking a video and telling him that people are getting sick and that we have families and that to stop the dumping, he got off the vehicle and pushed me and hit me, grabbed my phone, threw it to the floor, broke it, and then the security guard came and he also pushed me and I grabbed the phone to try to record it and he threw it to the floor. It got broke, that they got aggressive just because we were protesting.
Rivera wasn't about to back down after all the previous efforts, so one more time, he returned to protest.
Then after that, we went and protested again, and when we finished the protest, there's a cartel here from, the cartel is from Sinaloa, the one that they say from El Chapo. They're the ones basically that controls around this area and some of the workers that are there. In La Colonia, which is away from EcoWaste, every day there's gun violence. They're shooting at each other with New Generation Jalisco and also El Cartel de Sinaloa because they're fighting for this turf. We're in the middle. So I got threatened by the main man from the cartel here that for us to stop protesting.
The caregiver at Agape was not the only one getting threats because of involvement in the issue of toxic dumping in Tijuana.
Then with our attorney, they talked to him and then they offered him money to stop the lawsuit. He did not accept. And since he did not accept the money, they threatened his life also.
Attorney Jose Evaristo works with COSI, the Mexican equivalent of the ACLU, and is part of Pastor Albert Rivera's legal team.
The facility has all the equipment necessary to treat those black waters. Right now, the company that take care of that, they just dump into the dirt and they just put sand on it and that goes back to the ocean. That's a problem.
Rivera speaks about the complexities of the corrupt system surrounding toxic waste dumping in Tijuana.
The city shut it down because they came for inspection. But the thing is, when they shut it down on EcoWaste. But when they went to court and everything, well, EcoWaste doesn't exist. It does and it doesn't. They have their trucks and everything, but everything is on one person's name. And when they went to court, that's what he claimed. Wait a minute, you're saying you're shutting down EcoWaste. Okay, where's the paperwork of who's in charge of EcoWaste? And there was no paperwork and everything. And the judge like said, okay, well, you shut down the wrong place.
As the victims of toxic dumping acquire sophistication and assemble a strong legal team, they confront yet another facet of the prevailing system in Tijuana.
Right now, we have three attorneys that are working on the case, and we have filed complaints with 26 agencies of the government, municipal, state, federal. We have sent it to everyone, even since it's an international issue, even to the Secretary of State that represents Mexico, because it's an international issue, to the governor, to the mayor. What happened here in Mexico, because of too much corruption and everything, the Department of Environmental Protective Agency, like EPA from the United States, it used to be called here La Secretaría de Protección a Medio Ambiente, and that's what it states on the treaty. But with all this mess that we've been putting lawsuits and everything, they changed the names, and that name doesn't exist no more. Now the new name is La Secretaría de Economía Sustentable y Turismo. So basically, it's not the same name that the treaty states.
Again, attorney Jose Evaristo with COSI.
In Nueva Aurora, we have a problem. There is an EcoWaste, a company that should take care of the black waters. We have a big problem also in the neighbor because the contamination is so big in the neighbors. We are going to sue them on federal courts. We are preparing the documentation. So that way, the state, the court, the federal judge will give us protection for the health of our neighbors.
With the city's Punta Bandera sewage treatment plant at capacity and unable to accept more waste, the waste is instead being taken to the private contractor EcoWaste, which, although it has been permitted to accept the waste, has no treatment facilities.
The previous treatment plant for all this waste was closed, and they shut it down because it's overflow, no capacity at all no more. And legally, there was an order from a judge to shut it down, so it's closed. So now, at the last moment, the government, no one prepared for this to happen. So they gave all the permits that it's required to a place called EcoWaste here. But there's no plant, there's no treatment plant. They don't have anything. All they do is they just bring it and just are dumping it.
As the dumping continues, Pastor Albert Rivera gives us a sense of what one might expect as toxic chemicals accumulate in the region.
They're covering, they're putting dirt on top of it, just plain dirt. But part of it goes down to a river that goes all the way to the beach in Tijuana and, well, Rosarito and Imperial Beach. We have had problems because, you know, I live there in San Antonio del Mal, that's right in front of the beach. And we have had seals dead, fishes dead on our shores because of all this toxic.
That was Pastor Albert Rivera, director of Agape Misión Mundial in Tijuana, Mexico. Agape houses on the order of 150 refugees waiting in this border town in Baja California for their asylum hearings in the U.S. As part of the so-called migrant protection protocols, the U.S. makes asylum seekers wait in Mexico while they await court dates and decisions on their cases. This may require many months of waiting and typically requires multiple hearings for their case to be processed. Agape and all of the 32 such shelters in Tijuana is privately run and does not receive government funding. For Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy, this is Dave Adelson in Los Angeles. We'd like to thank Evan Davis, news director and program host at Pacifica affiliate WCRS 92.7 and 98.3 FM in Columbus, Ohio, for his ongoing coverage and interest in this topic.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Nana Jumphy. We now go to a special report on the effects of COVID-19 on urban indigenous communities from Pacifica's Larry Smith.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to an American Indian Airwaves special on how COVID-19 is impacting Native Americans, Indigenous peoples, and their respective First Nations. With approximately 2/3 to 3/4 of all Native Americans living in urban metropolitan areas, urban Indian organizations provide a crucial and pivotal role in providing the necessary health, social, cultural, and economic resources during the COVID-19 crisis. In a virtual media blackout, urban Indigenous organizations and how COVID-19 is impacting them and the larger urban Native American populations is largely underreported. In this American Indian Airwave special, I speak with Frances Crevier from the Algonquian First Nation. She's Executive Director of the National Council of Urban Indian Health based in Washington, D.C., where they work with over 74 urban Indian organizations. This is Frances Crevier and how COVID-19 is impacting urban indigenous populations and organizations.
Let's go back to H1N1. During H1N1, Natives were 4.1 times more likely to die of H1N1 than white Americans. And so we know that due to chronic health conditions that, you know, the CDC identifies as risk factors, such as, you know, diabetes, asthma, respiratory infections, coronary heart disease. Some of those health conditions are risk factors that'll make it more susceptible to get COVID-19. And so we're seeing that very true, but we also know that Natives are largely underreported based on the way that the government collects data to begin with. And so we won't have true numbers, but we do know based on a lot of these other data points that it will be hitting us much harder. And, you know, due to chronic underfunding and lack of access to healthcare as well, you know, it just makes for the perfect storm for something like COVID-19 to really impact us.
Frances, Congress recently passed the CARES Act, which only allocated $100 million for urban indigenous organizations. And your thoughts on that, and what are some of the additional critical infrastructural resources that are needed for urban indigenous organizations in order to provide the necessary services during this COVID-19 compounded crisis?
Well, first of all, a flexibility in funding is very important for some of these programs. You know, they'll just say, well, just for testing. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't allow for you to hire someone to test. And obviously this has, you know, shifted everyone's practices and business models and all these other things. And so we do need to be able to hire people. We do need to be able to purchase equipment. We do need to be able, you know, the way that the IHS integrated care model works is where there'll be a pod of three or four people, you know, behavioral health specialists or nurses in a little pod so that they're all together, which was nice before COVID-19. But now with COVID-19 and the need for social distancing, you have to completely change all your facilities to allow for that distancing. And so infrastructure funds have become an immediate urgency because, you know, not only are you trying to adapt to telehealth services, which, you know, some of our patients are fine with, but others are not, but trying to make sure everyone stays safe. And so infrastructure funding is a huge problem that we're hearing all throughout, as well as behavioral health funding. And I can imagine it's similar across the nation where behavioral health just plummeted with COVID-19. And so, you know, from all of our programs, we're hearing not only the needs of the patients, but the needs of the staff for people who've lost their loved ones or dealing with it themselves. And how do you go about that? And so behavioral health has become a very urgent need as well to be able to kind of help provide more access to those services as the need has, you know, and sometimes threefold, not only for behavioral health, but domestic violence services. So, you know, there's a lot of funding there. Now there's an issue as well where I think like corporations or foundations can come in because some of our patients need broadband and they need cell phones with video. And those are things that is you can't really, you know, under government regulations, you can't really purchase. But if someone needs their medication and doesn't have anyone to call, or if someone, you know, is really struggling mentally and doesn't have the ability to do behavioral health services, that's really going to impact our people. Not to mention people who have had to lose their jobs. They don't have rent. They don't have rent money. They don't have electricity. They don't have food. These are things that the government technically, under their current regulations, can't pay for, but, you know, other flexible funding can. And so we did partner actually with Johns Hopkins to develop a fund for those more flexible needs. But there's definitely a large need out there that we need to, you know, be able to address as well to make sure that we don't just now increase homelessness and, you know, those other issues.
Frances, urban indigenous organizations are vital foundations for urban Native American populations. Are we seeing any particular COVID-19 hotspots severe deficits of infrastructure and resources that are so crucial for urban indigenous organizations to provide those economic, social, and cultural resources that are so vital to urban Native American populations.
So in infrastructure, all of our facilities are having a hard time. But in terms of hotspots, our Santa Clara facility has been has kind of been the epicenter there. It's, you know, they still have a 13% test positive rate when the national average is about 10%. So that's definitely a hot spot. You know, Arizona is starting to bloom quite a bit in terms of COVID cases, and we have 3 urban programs in Arizona. So that's definitely, you know, starting to grow as well.
And that was Stacy Crevier of the Algonquian First Nations, Executive Director of the National Council of Urban Indian Health, speaking on how COVID-19 is impacting Native American urban populations across the United States. That concludes our special for American Indian Airwaves on how COVID-19 is impacting Native Americans. I've been your host, Larry Smith. Until next time.
Go to producer Ann Garrison with Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
2 of the most recent deaths of Black people under police fire took place in Louisville, the largest city in the state of Kentucky. Breonna Taylor, an emergency medical technician, was shot while sleeping in her own home on March 13th. Barbecue chef David McAtee was shot at the entrance to his own barbecue just after midnight on June 1st. I spoke to Tia Marie, a popular DJ at Pacifica affiliate WXOX 97.1 FM Louisville, who has been on the front lines of the struggle there. Tia, I understand that you attended the memorial for Breonna Taylor on Friday, June 5th. Could you tell us about that?
For her birthday, which was celebrated in downtown Louisville, an amazing event. It was beautiful. It was peaceful. There were hundreds of people in attendance. It was just one of the most amazing things for me to see, having been on the front line of these protests since the beginning, and see just the beauty in people coming together and celebrating her life together. They had their event. They went down, they celebrated her life, they stood for justice, they still protested, and the city was left beautiful, clean. The work was done, but without all of the negative side of things that everyone's trying to project. So it was an amazing day.
None of the officers who fired on Breonna Taylor and her boyfriend have been arrested, right?
That is true. We are still waiting on any level of responsibility to be given to the officers who fired on Breonna Taylor and the rest of the apartment complex that evening.
Now, this isn't easy to listen to, but I'm going to play the 911 call that Breonna's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, made after plainclothes police burst in and shot Breonna.
911, Operator Harris, where is your emergency?
I don't know what's happening. Somebody kicked in the door and shot my girlfriend.
Okay, where are you located?
Oh, man, 3.
Okay, and you said you're in apartment number 4?
Help! Oh, my God! Yes, help!
What's
help.
Your name, sir?
Oh, my name is Kim Walker.
You said Kim?
Help!
And you said she's 26?
Yes.
Okay, you said 3003 Springfield Drive, apartment number 4.
Yes.
Okay. Can you check and see where she's been shot at?
I can't get on her stomach. No, I
okay. Can't. Is she alert and able to talk to you?
No, Bree. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I can't see you. Oh my God.
Can you get her turned over on her back? I need you to check her and see where she shot at.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I'm gonna go. Okay. I'm gonna go back.
Kenneth, can you hear me?
It's hard to find words for how shocking and tragic that is. And wasn't Kenneth Walker then put in jail until the recording of this call was released?
Yes, he was.
What were they charging him with?
Well, there were multiple charges, but one I remember hearing was the attempt to kill an officer. Kenneth is a great guy. He has no prior criminal record. He was simply a man that was licensed to carry that was trying to protect his home. And because of that, and because obviously there was some kind of cover-up trying to happen, he had to be jailed for that. And it took public attention and more evidence to come out before he was able to be released and the charges dropped.
Sharon Scott, the general manager of WXOX 97.1 FM Louisville, said that there was a real uprising after the 911 call was made public.
Absolutely, because it was the information that was necessary to help us understand the mentality, the mindset that Kenneth was in when his family was barged in on. I mean, you could hear from the call that he had no idea who was in his home. And he tried to do what he was supposed to do for his family, and that was protect his family. So yes, of course, people were very upset when they heard the authenticity in his voice that he was genuinely scared and did not know who was in his home.
And he was actually calling for help from the same people who had just charged in and shot his girlfriend, right?
Exactly.
Okay. And what about the tragedy just after midnight when Louisville police and Air National Guard fired on barbecue chef David McCatty? What do you know about that so far?
So what I know about that, and being a resident of Louisville, I've lived in Louisville all my life, and I know that corner very well. That area of Louisville is a gathering place. It's legendary for that. The community comes together in that area. They have been doing it for decades. David McCatty was a beautiful community member who didn't even live in the area any longer. He actually lived very far away from there, and he would still come downtown to take care of the people in the area. And so that night, even though the curfew was set, members of the community were out, and David McAtee was doing what he does best. Yaya was basically providing food for folks. The police and the National Guard were sent in to disperse the crowd. And it's just very unfortunate because it was a peaceful gathering. There was no threats present except for the police and the National Guard that showed up. And a man lost his life because of their aggression that they brought to the location.
And were young folks whom the police were trying to disperse, those who ran in under the canopy and into the backyard of David McAtee's barbecue, were they protesting or just socializing after the curfew?
I believe that they were just socializing. There were no more organized protests that were occurring in that area. So I do believe it to have been just socializing.
That's terrible. And it's what we have time for today, but there are still a lot of unanswered questions. So let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Call me anytime. Okay. Absolutely.
And that was Tia Marie, host of the Tia Maria Show with Tia Marie on Tuesdays at 4 p.m. EST and Soul Glow Radio on Tuesdays at 5 p.m. EST, both on Pacifica affiliate WXOX 97.1 FM Louisville. In Berkeley for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's special national broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. The following story comes from Frieda Worden, series producer for WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. Here's Frieda.
The precautions needed to prevent the spread of COVID-19 are quite similar all over the world. Reporter Patience Wingo is based in Cameroon, Central Africa. She interviewed a fellow journalist about how to stay safe while covering the pandemic.
Braving the odds to curb the spread of the coronavirus, journalist with the Cameroon Radio Television, Helen Goh, has been following up and reporting the evolution of the pandemic.
Sometimes I've been assigned to cover the daily press briefings done by the Ministry of Public Health at the Health Emergency Operations Center in Yaoundé. So that's a lot of people who come from different places. No one knows exactly what they've been exposed to. So it's one of those things that you have to be really careful about. I try as much as possible to minimize the risk I'm exposed to. So for one, I would wear a face covering. Disposable surgical masks are really becoming very scarce these days, and in any case should be left for health professionals who are on the front line, in my opinion. So I would have a reusable mask with me. Also, I'm armed with my hand sanitizer always. I will just try and avoid touching surfaces that people have touched. For example, you'd have a door handle. You don't know how many people would have opened that door before you that day. So I would have my hand sanitizer ready so that if I open the door, I immediately sanitize after, before touching any other thing that I'm carrying on me. Usually that will be my phone. So I would do that, and I would try not to sit at the table with everyone else, because then, of course, you're closer to people than you'd be comfortable with. So I would just back myself into a wall and just keep some distance between me and the nearest person. And then when I'm done collecting the information that I needed, I will then just go over to the car, sit in there and put my story together and record it and file it in by email. In so doing, I'm trying as much as possible to limit the number of people I have to interact with before my story goes on air. Now, sometimes that's not always possible, and I have to come back to base, get into a recording studio, or maybe use one of the computers to edit all the work that I have to do. I mean, then there's nothing you can do. You have to sit where someone else has sat. You have to touch things that other people have touched. So I would try to minimize the risk by using alcohol to just wipe down surfaces that I think people have touched before me. I know this sounds a little bit compulsive, like you have OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, but yeah, it's some of the things that I would do to just make myself think that I'm trying to keep safe in times that are really quite frightful. So I would use the alcohol and wipe down the chair I'm sitting on, wipe down the mouse I'm going to use, wipe down the keyboard, perhaps the table as well. And then I would work constantly sanitizing my hands from time to time. It's exhausting at some point to keep doing this over and over again. But again, they say prevention is better than cure. And for now, all what we have is, you know, the preventive measures while waiting for a vaccine, which we hope would come soon. Because in my opinion, I think that would be one of the best ways to just have life go back to pre-COVID-19, if that's even possible at this point. But yeah, so we're stuck in this world where we have to stay away from people. We have to be watchful.
Helen Gore is a journalist working with the Cameroon Radio Television. Patience Wingo reporting for Wings in Cameroon.
This interview first aired in the June 8th episode of Wings, Women's International News Gathering Service. For Pacifica, I'm Frida Worden.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev. Special thanks to the Pacific COVID Task Force, to Verna Avery Brown at WPFW, and to Fernando Velasquez at KPFK for advice and support. I'm Nana Jumphy. You can listen to past editions of the show and support Pacifica Radio at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening, and make sure to tune in tomorrow.